This is an AMI podcast. This is an AMI podcast.
I'm Kelly McDonald. Here's a segment from our show, Kelly and Company, that airs weekdays from 2 to 4 p.m. Eastern on AMI Audio. Locate AMI Audio on your TV, Rogers Channel 196 and SaskTel Channel 555 in Saskatchewan. Visit AMI.ca/schedules for a list of channel location in your area. Ramya Muth and Kelly McDonald, we're the hosts of the show. Welcome back to the Friday edition. Appreciate you being with us.
And on Fridays, we like to get a bit of an app update because there's always something going on in the app world, especially when it comes to accessibility. So let's bring on John Beeler of the App Show.
This is the App Show, unlocking software secrets for smartphones, tablets, TVs, and more.
John, I know I said accessibility, but I actually meant to say sleep because a study shows that the night shift feature in iOS, and maybe you can break down what this is supposed to be anyways. I know I use it. I just don't remember why. It doesn't help users sleep any better. Why is this and what's going on?
Yeah, this is the feature that basically is meant to reduce the blue light emissions from your phone. And the sort of the thought behind it, and now it seems like the marketing behind it, is that it actually will help you have a better sleep because it's not as intense of a light, typically for people that use their phone just before they go to bed. And researchers at Brigham Young University did a bunch of sleep studies testing this feature out. And it's not just Apple that does this. Android and a lot of other manufacturers now incorporate some version of this night shift mode in their phones. They actually discovered that it doesn't really make any difference whatsoever. The key point that I took from the report was something that they said that was really, really interesting. It doesn't matter how tired you are. If you're really super tired, you're going to fall asleep regardless what you just did. Right.
Yeah.
So whether you use a phone or not, they didn't have any measurable increases in the quality or the length of your sleep in the groups that didn't use the night shift function that just uses their phones normally. I think it might be like a more pleasant experience where you're using your phone to have not such an intense white light, for example, unless you're using dark mode on your phone. But it's just interesting that there's now science to back up the fact that this really might not make that much of a difference, at least to your sleep pattern.
Well, and I would think that balancing it off, why so many people have their smart device doing something at night, whether you're listening to sleep sounds or something that's to help you sleep, that's it all gets kind of mashed up, because for those who say, oh no, that light's really affecting you sleeping, you have just as many people that, oh yeah, I have to have that sound to go to sleep or be listening to an audiobook or something. Like, how do you balance that information in a study?
Exactly, because I mean, a study is also probably a fairly weird experience for those people trying to sleep with scientists watching them. But I don't know to like what degree of this sleep study was like. Was it in your home or was it in a lab setting? You know, that type of thing. So I think you're right. I think there's lots of other factors and just sort of your nightly ritual before you go to bed that can contribute to all that. You know, if you're thinking about work or something like, you know,
most people, the way it's been presented is the light itself is what's keeping people from sleeping properly. And we take the bare bones of that and people get thinking, oh, okay, well then I'm supposed to be away from it altogether. Well, hold on. We've got this dark mode. So that means that it won't mess up your sleep as much. Or I think too many people take it too literal.
I would agree. Yes, for sure.
Ram, do you have something there? I keep cutting you off. Sorry.
No. I was just thinking that, you know, the blue light thing, there's so much that trends so quickly that maybe there's just not enough scientific evidence behind why we're doing it or whatever. And then when big, you know, like flagship phones and companies start promoting it also, like, you know, blue light filtering, when it came on and you could just turn it on automatically and then you didn't even have to do it yourself anymore. You could just schedule it right into night mode or night shift. Sorry. You think, okay, perfect, I'm helping myself out. But then these things come out and you're like, well, what's the point then?
Let's talk a little bit about Facebook. This really kind of puzzles me what's going on here. Again, seeing Facebook trying to get onto something a little different, launching neighborhoods across Canada and select cities in the U.S. What are they up to?
Are you guys familiar with Nextdoor, the app?
Yes. Yeah.
So the idea behind this is Nextdoor's sort of elevator pitch was always, this is kind of like Facebook for your neighborhood. You have to verify that you actually live in your neighborhood. And typically that meant they would send you out a postcard with a special code on it, proving that you're actually in that neighborhood before you could sign up to Nextdoor. Now Facebook has basically cloned that functionality. And essentially what they've done is they've taken, you know, the notion of a Facebook group, but localized it, hyper-localized it to your neighborhood. So only people that live in your neighborhood, again, I'm presuming if you turn on location tracking so that you can actually verify that, mm-hmm. integrating these little mini groups of your random neighbors that you may or may not want to be friends with. So I think the intent is really good. One of the things that actually turned me off of Nextdoor, though, was when the pandemic started, a lot of people were very polarized about their thoughts on the pandemic and all the negative things that you could think of that would go with that. And having a place where they can voice their opinions loudly to their neighbors without actually having to leave, you know, their patio, it got really messy really quickly. And I actually uninstalled the app because I just found it was just too volatile, you know, and we weren't even talking politics, right? I mean, it was just like anti-masking and all this other stuff. And I think there's, you know, if you want to coordinate like a garage sale or something like that, this kind of thing is fantastic. Apparently there is something that pointed Facebook to doing this in Canada first, because there's this movement that apparently started in Toronto called caremongering.
Yes, checking on people, right? Checking on your neighbor. We heard a lot of that, and just being sure of that person who lives on their own or that elderly person, let's check on them and let's now give a way of being careful. And that's what I first thought when you brought it up, until you mentioned the stuff of getting into topics. And that's what we always do, even if we're sitting out front across the street with people and somebody, you know, hey, you're not wearing a mask, I don't believe in it.
Well, it escalates very quickly, especially when you're sort of hiding behind your screen. I guess the concern here is that if somebody in your neighborhood turns out to be a very aggressive person towards you, normally on Facebook, you wouldn't even know that they're your neighbor. But with this neighborhood app and with Nextdoor, you kind of do. And now you're kind of like on edge, like, well, do I avoid this person? And this probably wouldn't be that hard to figure out who it is based on their profile photo or what other, you know, information they've shown. Like, they're in the gardening, you know, the garden on the corner has all the big garden, you know, that kind of thing. Like, it's not hard to figure these things out. I think it's interesting. The curious missing piece, at least in what I've read so far, is what kind of moderation is happening. Like, is it self-moderated, or is there actually going to be moderators from Facebook sort of checking into keeping the conversation at the right kind of level and speed for the participants?
The neighborhood watch captain would be the one checking on that. That's why it's select cities in the States. You don't want to get anyone mad.
Yeah, and I mean, we're quick to kind of have our opinions about Facebook and things that they start, but really, this kind of thing, like with Nextdoor, you know, it could go any which way, right? And especially when you bring up projects in a time frame like this, where it's unprecedented and you kind of don't know where things can go, it can get really beautiful or it can get really ugly, or both.
I think they're probably going to experience both sides of that coin.
Yeah.
I think it's just the nature of people. So.
Yeah, exactly. John, next up on your list, it's once again time to update our iPhones, Macs, and Apple Watches as soon as possible. Are we in trouble again?
Yeah, we are.
Okay.
So we just talked about not too long ago about a pretty big update across all of Apple's devices. On the iPhone and iPad is 14.5. Well, very quickly, they released 14.5.1, and they also updated a similar update for the macOS and even your Apple Watch. And it's important because there's apparently a code execution exploit present in WebKit. And WebKit is this sort of kind of like a mini browser that lives in all of your Apple devices, so that, say, you're using an app and you need to show a map or you need to show like a directory listing, it's using basically a version of a browser, kind of like a mini shrunk down Safari to show you that content. The problem is that that particular mechanism is a good vector for hackers to get in. So they put out this update. Generally, when you see a 0.1 on these updates, that usually means it's a pretty important bug fix. In this case, Apple's made it very clear that this is a major security update. So without hesitation, you should apply and update all of your devices if you have anything on the Apple space.
Yeah, it's good to have. I mean, in times like this, honestly, I find it good to have the automatic updates turned on, because sometimes by the time you even figure out that there's another update, depending on how often you check or the notifications coming in and you actually pay attention, these bugs and glitches and kind of terrors of things that happen would happen, right? Because we're taking too long to update between updates. Like the 14.5 one, we're anticipating, we're looking forward to it, but some of the things that come with the necessary updates afterwards, we're not necessarily paying attention to.
Absolutely. And it gets even trickier with if you have an older device too, which may or may not even support some of the new features in 14.5, for example. But they've apparently updated, even if you have an older version of iOS, they actually updated iOS 12 for iPhone 5Ss, 6s, even iPad Airs, and the older iPad Minis as well. So it's that big of a deal. They've even updated really old versions of iOS just to patch this problem.
Yeah.
Wow. That says so how heavy the problem, you know, or potentially can be and destructive.
Yeah, and I think that's the key point here. It's a potential. I don't think there's been any examples of any exploits, but you know, Apple's just covering their bases and making sure everyone's as protected as they can be.
Okay. YouTube doing a little testing and playing around here with automatic translations in the user's native language. How is this all going so far?
Yeah, this is really interesting. I don't know if you remember last year, they had community captions on YouTube. So that's where you could actually submit your own translations of a video, you know, for the creator that made the video. So if you wanted it in your native language, you could translate it for it. And they kind of got rid of it. I don't know why. There must have been some problem with it. And so they've started using their, you know, Google has one of the best translation services in the world as far as near real time, if not real time, translations and, you know, conversion of one language to another. And you know, they're, the translation tool supports up to 108 different languages. So it makes sense that YouTube would sort of start to integrate this. But I think it's kind of interesting that they've actually made it so that whatever version or whatever language you have turned on as your default language on your YouTube account could potentially become your automatic translation for your subtitles in multiple languages. Apparently, this has only been seen so far in a few different languages like Portuguese and Turkish with English. But I think it's because they're testing this and they're trying it on a small subset of the languages that maybe are trickier to do this with, that type of thing. So I think it's just going to be interesting to see how this evolves over time, and then you'll be able to get real-time translations, transcriptions, et cetera, on almost any kind of content you can imagine that Google has, you know, their hands in that pie, which I think is exciting for everybody.
It's nice that, you know, Google's already, like with this translation feature, I mean, it's already something we can really, really rely on. A lot of people are familiar with it already. You're maybe by default going to Google. So when they roll out things like this, you're more keen than not, right, at something like this being successful.
Yeah, well, and they've certainly been doing it probably one of the longest of all the companies doing this, and they just keep buying up the companies that are also doing it well. So, but yeah, you know, they throw in artificial intelligence, machine learning, and all that good stuff, and giving people the tools to say, hey, this is wrong, that just makes the AI engine smarter, and eventually we're going to get into some very slick real time. Like natural language translations, right? Like, because that's the biggest problem with a lot of these services, whether it's for, you know, visual subtitles, or whether it's even just for conversion from a language to another language audibly, is the nuances, it's the dialects, it's all the regional differences in some of these languages that have the biggest problem. So the more people that are, you know, using these services, the better the systems
get. The better it's going to get.
Right. So it's an interesting thing to see. Like I said, this is still just sort of rolling out like in a really limited basis right now, but
absolutely. John, we got to wrap up here. It will. Thank you so much for the app update. We'll talk to you on Friday.
Sounds good.
Well, next Friday. John Beeler of The App Show. Check them out 4 p.m. Eastern on Saturdays on AMI Audio.
A recent graduate of the CNIB Guide Dog Program has found his home as a buddy dog. Karen McGee in Ottawa has the story next.
You've been listening to Kelly and Company. If you're hooked, subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast platform. And be sure to leave us a rating and review. Or you can listen live from 2 to 4 p.m. Eastern on AMI Audio.
This was an AMI podcast. For more accessible media, visit AMI.ca.